the new map that put me back in charge. I found my way back to owning my life, to using my voice to put good into the world, to valuing the right relationships, and to being the kind of mother to Nico that gave purpose and meaning to everything. I was back. Chapter 13, My President is Black. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, which came out in June 2004, had a profound impact on me. Without knowing it at the time, the political documentary influenced how I saw my role on radio and opened my eyes to issues in the hip-hop culture that I could use my voice to amplify. Up until seeing the movie about how the Bush administration had used the post-9/11 fear and the media to build a case for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I didn't want anything to do with politics. Whenever I tried to pay attention to what was going on, most of it was confusing and there was too much lying and bullshit to try to cut through that it always turned me off. Maybe politics scared me. But for some reason, Moore's ability to tell the story with facts and audacity made me want to investigate and not ignore these bigger political issues that were affecting us all. Obviously, his was one perspective, and there were others, but I was inspired to start asking more questions and to do my own research. It was time to widen the conversation, not just with points of view that resonated with mine and what is probably 90% of my audience who I thought would be interested in the movie too, but also with that 10% that would most likely hate the movie. That's when I got the idea to do something that I'd never done before with my listeners, which was take a bunch of them to go see Fahrenheit 9/11 with me. I'd come back from seeing it and had just been moved by it. As a piece of filmmaking, I had never seen a delivery like that in a documentary. And because it was so interesting and so powerful and thought-provoking on so many levels, I wanted to bring it up on air as something current to recommend. My first idea, as I proposed to my boss, was to give some tickets away on the radio. And I got the green light. Sure, whatever you want. From there, I called the movie theater, bought enough tickets to buy out the place, and then gave tickets away on air so that we all went to see the film together. It was an amazing experience to see my listeners in person and watch the movie and then have something to talk about later on air. A short time later, I had the opportunity to interview Michael Moore on the show. When he called in, I realized that he didn't know about the ticket giveaway and how we'd gone out to see the movie together. He was blown away. The one thing he didn't know, he said, was that my audience and I helped him get his street cred. Fahrenheit 9/11 catalyzed my listeners, and I think it affected many young voters who had been apathetic in the past. This was at a time when Rock the Vote, which partnered with MTV, had been around for a while, but it started to make inroads around the time of the 2004 campaign season. That growing consciousness for young voters wasn't as evident then as it would be 4 years later, but you could feel a shift as people who weren't as informed before as they might have been started to become more politically involved. The Rock the Vote approach was powerful, encouraging people to vote as an easy way to inspire everyone who had voices to use them. It was also nonpartisan. So getting younger voters engaged was another method to get people to say something positive, get them involved in an easy, non-committal way. They didn't have to pick a side. They didn't have to choose a party. They didn't have to voice their political view. For celebrities who may not feel comfortable taking a stance, something like Rock the Vote was a brilliant way to let them get out there and promote activism without being partisan. This period opened the door to have more conversations with politicians. Back when Hillary Clinton was first running to represent New York in the U.S. Senate, her campaign staff reached out and set up a phone interview. It was a great, quick conversation, and I did appreciate the fact that she thought it was important to speak to my audience. That's what her staffer said. She wants to talk to your audience. During the interview, when she talked about her desire to hold elected office, even after being the first lady, I was impressed by her commitment to public service. I was impressed by her knowledge and her confidence. And in wrapping up the interview, I jokingly said, "Well, good luck, and if my listeners help you win the Senate seat, don't forget to call back and thank them." She laughed and promised she would. And sure enough, she did. Both interviews were memorable. And I was left thinking it was pretty cool and pretty smart of her to reach out to an audience that a lot of others would have overlooked. It was either cool and smart of her to think of it or to listen to people on her team who helped make that connection. By this point, having politicians on my show was not that uncommon. Former President Bill Clinton called in when he opened his office in Harlem. Ted Kennedy called in to talk about immigration reform. And Cory Booker, who was the mayor of Newark at the time, was on air often and would become a friend to the show. He even allowed me to tag along a couple times to watch the great work he was doing in the community. During the holidays, he introduced me to the mayor of Jersey City and we served Thanksgiving dinner at a local shelter. I joined Corey, Queen Latifah, and Wyclef on a bus tour in Newark in 2009, going door to door to inform residents about the government assistance available to avoid foreclosure at a time when people really needed it. About a month after the Michael Moore interview, I found myself watching the Democratic convention. The first time I had ever watched a nominating convention in my life. Again, politics had never been my thing, even to the point of feeling over my head. By then, after Fahrenheit 9/11, I had decided to start paying greater attention. So I chose to tune into the convention. And I'll never forget watching the keynote speech by Barack Obama, a candidate running for the Illinois U.S. Senate, and how he looked like such a star to me. All I could think was, why don't I know who this man is? Why doesn't everybody know who he is? His ideas resonated for me, and I believed in him from that moment. I bought and read his book, Dreams for My Father, and I bought it for my friends and guests of the show. Long before it was even a topic of conversation, I started telling people Barack Obama could be president one day. For the longest time, all the way to the election, in fact, I'd get into arguments with a lot of people who were adamant. There's no way we would ever have a black president. No, this is the guy. I'm telling you, this is the guy. From that 04 convention on, I felt invested and raised my level of wanting to be informed about policy and decision that affect us domestically and globally. Not that I think of myself even today as politically savvy, but as a citizen and a parent, I choose to look at a bigger picture. Not just as the headlines or the stories that the news deems important for ratings. The lesson learned is that once you begin to get information from multiple sources and use your own judgment, you can never go back. I can never just not care or not be informed or not pay attention. Before, when I was younger, I thought, how does it affect me? What does it matter? There's no difference in my life from day to day. Now I know better. I've never been afraid of controversy on the air. Not much could top the Tupac interview. So my feeling was that as long as I maintained honesty and fairness, something authentic and provocative could happen on air and be worth it. In November of 2005, I had an interesting and controversial situation on the show that I didn't see coming. But when it did, I know Puffy wasn't happy about it. For the past 6 years or so, I had not felt good about what happened with Shine. Then, a 21-year-old rapper with so much potential who had been signed to Bad Boy. I first met Shine when he was a teenager delivering packages to Hot 97. He would always promise he was going to be on my show one day. So when Shine actually started making noise as an artist, I couldn't help but to root for him. I never knew what had gone on in Puffy's mind or why he'd handled things the way he did. But after the nightclub shooting that led to Shine being convicted, I always felt like he had been left for dead. And so I would visit him periodically while he was in prison in Rikers and Clinton Correctional Facility. And we wind up becoming much better friends when he was in jail than when I knew him outside. The fact is that when you go visit somebody in jail, you're forced to really talk. Sitting across from someone for hours at a time, you try to say things that are real and that matter. In the process, my feelings for Puff were not good. Granted, this was from Shine's perspective of how Puff treated him while he was going through this. But it had actually started when Shine first got sentenced. Suge Knight came to my show and basically said on the radio that Puff dry snitched on Shine because Puffy had to put somebody on the stand to defend and help himself. But it hurt Shine. I didn't say anything at that point, although I knew that Shine felt the same way. I was just quiet. Puff took great offense to that and went to Flex's show that night and went after me, saying something to the effect of, you know, everybody talking this gossip, talking rumors, this Wendy Williams shit, this Angie Martinez shit. Basically, by doing that publicly, all he did was give me reason to draw my line in the sand. You know what? I don't like you anyway. Now you give me a reason to not fuck with you. I didn't say a word. But a month later, I saw Puff backstage at a concert, and he came very close to my personal space saying, what's up, Ange? We have a problem? Do we have issues? He was not asking, but telling, leaning over me or leaning into me. I need you to back up, I told him. You are too close to me. It was very hostile. And mutual. We both were just not feeling each other. And I was okay with that. Because I would rather that than have to fake it. So I barely spoke to Puff for the next few years. And I did not have him on my show once. It was in that time, in 05, when we weren't good, that this conversation happened about questionable practices at Bad Boy. On my show that day, I had Jadakiss, Chic Looch, and Styles P from The Lox. I loved The Lox. And Styles P in particular is one of my favorite people in the whole rap game. As a person, I think he's as authentic as they come, and we always clicked. Anyway, when they came to the show, they decided that they were going to put their relationship with Puffy on blast. They outed him for taking advantage of them when they were young and accused him of stealing their publishing money when they had first signed a Bad Boy. They wanted their money and they wanted out of their Bad Boy contract. So the Locks are on my show talking about how Puffy sold them the old story. We're family. We take care of you. Family for life. Bad boy for life. And when the Locks started to voice their gripes, Puffy's defense was something along the lines of, well, it's just business. This problem happened in the music business a lot. Didn't make it right. They were kids. You're taking them out of the hood, acting like you're their family, and then defending questionable practices with just business. That's a confusing message. And aspects of all that came up on the air. All the members of the Locks were going in on Puff, talking crazy stuff like pushing a refrigerator off a building onto him. There was nothing I could say. Again, I did not jump to Puff's defense because ultimately I didn't think I should. My boss Tracy came into the studio and took me aside. Look, Puff called. He wants to call into the show. What? Yeah, he wants to talk to the Locks. I let the Locks know it was totally up to them. They welcomed it. Fine. The minute Puff calls in and gets on the air, he immediately tries to turn the tables as the wronged and yet reasonable party, talking to the Locks like misbehaving kids. Puffy, I'm at my office now. I'm always accessible. And y'all ain't got to get on the radio and do certain things to holler at me. I told Jadakiss I'm accessible. I said if somebody's standing in the way of you expressing yourself, y'all could come get at me directly. You know what I'm saying? A refrigerator ain't gonna kill nobody. We businessmen. We mature adults. All that right there, I'm at my office right now and y'all could sit there and interview with her and talk as long as you want to talk. Or you could take the invitation I gave you before. But it's not even getting there because of your getting on the radio. Because I ain't your enemy. Jadakiss and Styles P. Dog, just yesterday we got a note from your office saying you don't want nothing of this. None of it. We just saw you at the concert at the Hova and you said you'd find out what it was. Puffy. Don't sit here and portray that Puff took something from y'all. Jadakiss. What is it? What is it then? What do you call it? And don't say we can come to your office and none of that because we can't do that. We can't handle it no other way with the lawyers and you know that. So don't get on the radio and act like a tough guy. You acting tough. Puffy. You know how we can settle this. At the office. So why don't we stop talking on the radio? Jadakiss. You just want to stop talking because you don't want to know the truth. Styles P. We made one record with you, Money, Power, and Respect. It's 10 years later and you still got half of our publishing. And it's no way you can make it justifiable that you deserve half of our publishing. Puffy. You didn't say that to my face. Voices from the Locks. You a coward. You a thief. Puffy. Come to the office so we can straighten it out. Styles P. You had a bunch of artists whose careers never went right with you. Be for real, dog. Like, look at the list. 112 not happy with you. Gone. Faith not happy with you. Gone. We not happy with you. Gone. Mace not happy with you. Gone. Jadakiss. B.I.G. dead. Shine in jail. Angie, after silence on the other end. Wow. He's gone. The next day, the whole city was talking about it. And when Puff wanted to come up to the show on his own, I advised that he wait a few days for things to simmer down. But he pushed. Nah, I want to come up there today. Okay. His first matter of business was to come for me, insisting that I was pitting artists against each other in interviews. But I didn't back down. And you can hear the hostility too. Like, he's not fucking with me and I'm not fucking with him. Ultimately, I let him have his say. And the Locks got their publishing back. And that to me felt like I had done my part in resolving their issues. By that point in my career, I had developed my voice and built a platform. And I realized that day that sometimes the right thing to do is to pick a side. Because ultimately, if you can use your voice to make a difference in somebody else's life, that is what you leave behind. I didn't want to let being impartial get in the way of doing right in the culture. Yes, as a radio host, I try to be fair to everybody. But I also care about the people and I care about what's right. The Locks getting their publishing back was right. It's not just about the Locks specifically. It also sends a message to the industry and upcoming rappers to be mindful of their business practices. And I was proud to be part of that conversation. Eventually, everything smoothed out between Puff and the Locks. And years later, would get smoothed out between me and Puff. I've gotten less judgmental as I've gotten older. And being fair, the reality is that I don't know why he handled things like he did. And I have no idea how I would have handled things if put in similar circumstances. the year 2007 was about to go down as the worst year in the music industry. CD sales dropped, labels were consolidating, jobs were cut, iTunes was putting music retail stores out of business, and small artists were struggling to stay alive. Kanye West and 50 Cent were the exception to that, when each sold nearly 1 million copies on their first week out. From that position, 50 Cent came on my show criticizing indie label Koch, calling it the graveyard for artists. He managed to offend a lot of people, including Cam'ron and Styles P from The Lox. Both called into the show that day and got a little heated. Off air, 50 and I argued about whether or not he was a bully. When I say argue, I use the word loosely. There's something about sparring with smart people that I enjoy, even if our perspectives are different. I've gotten that from all the years of trying to get to the point during interviews. I like to get to the point quickly. I hate small talk. It makes me want to punch myself in the face repeatedly. Radio has only magnified that impatience. As Ebro and I used to say, in radio, there's no foreplay. You got to get right to the fucking. The problem for me was that for all my growth in this period, I had become more impatient than ever. Just ask any of my assistants and members of my team who I mentored. Don't write a 3-paragraph email to me when it should only take one sentence. It makes me crazy. On the upside, because I was tough and exacting, those who could handle it have gone on to thrive, like Monse and then TJ, my friend Tracy's little cousin who started as my assistant as a kid and would go on to be an engineer for Beats Radio, and my producer Drewski, all who would have my back throughout these later years at Hot. I used to call these guys my other sons, because as tough and impatient as I could be, there was nothing I wouldn't do for anyone on my team, and they all knew it. As I evolved, I began to feel less guilty about running a tight ship. It was necessary. As much fun as we were having, this was a job. We needed to be efficient and productive and on top of our game. So almost daily, I would be kicking someone out of the studio who didn't belong there. I tried to teach everyone who worked with me about boundaries. My friend Adrian Bylon says that's one of the most important things she's learned from me. That people will take advantage of you if you don't set boundaries. I met Adrian when she was 13 in a group called 3LW. She had so much personality, and I just felt a connection with her immediately. She's somebody I wanted to look after, and I always have. To this day, she calls me her big sister. I began to see that I had some life experiences worth sharing with others, and I found confidence in that. I was now seasoned. I had been in the game for a long time. I'd seen a lot, and I had great relationships that I valued. I tried to show up for people whenever I could. I never wanted to disappoint anyone, and I often found myself saying yes to too much. I probably needed some boundaries my damn self in this area. There were appearances and social events that were part of doing what I do, and sometimes, even if I was tired or had too much on my plate, there were certain people I made sure I showed up for. Like the time that Fabulous was having his 30th birthday party. Fab and I had known each other for years, and he often showed up for me. He was having a great year with his new album, From Nothing to Something, and the party was packed with so many people. I knew that every time I tried to leave, somebody else pulled me over. As the night got later, I could feel almost a dizzying exhaustion starting to set in, along with my impatience to go home. For the last time, I announced to whoever, I gotta fucking go. And I walked out with Pecas, making sure I got to my Range Rover. I climbed in and started on the 20-minute drive home to my apartment. About a block away from pulling into my complex, I start to fall asleep at the wheel. And in that split second, I jolt myself back and slam on the brakes. Only instead of hitting the brakes, I slam the gas so hard that it slaps me into a parked car. I crash so hard into the parked car that as it flies up and over the curve, my Range Rover skids into a massive metal gate as everything is literally crushed around me. It's like I've woken up in a metal coffin with a car caved in everywhere around me, except for my little space where I'm sitting. For a second, I think, this is it. This is the end. Death. Then I black out again. And when I come back, I see spinning police lights and hear sirens, and I'm standing barefoot in the street with glass all around me, just standing there. How? I'm in this tiny little gold lamé dress that barely covers my ass. Where are my shoes? Somehow in the crash, I must have lost my shoes. My focus is going in and out. First, I'm sitting back in my car, seeing myself standing there barefoot in the street. Then I'm turning to see two cops walking toward me, one of them saying, "Stay where you are, don't move." When I blink, I'm looking at the two officers putting me in their car. In the next moment, I'm seated in the back seat and looking back at me in my crashed car. None of it connected. At one point, one of the cops said, "Stop moving." The other asked, "Are you okay?" "I am," I told them, which was ridiculous. I was not. They asked if I had been drinking. And though I'd had one drink earlier in the night, I explained it had been a long day and I was exhausted and had fallen asleep. "Are you sure you're okay?" the cop asked. "Yeah," I said, pointing across the street. "I live right there." "I don't know," one of them questioned. "You're really okay?" "I'm fine." They did not give me a breathalyzer test. They did not take me to the hospital to check me for a concussion or brain trauma. They just assessed that the Range Rover was totaled. So they insisted on driving me across the street to my house. As I recalled it the next day, my out-of-body experience continued as they ran my license and had me sit in the car. That was when I was again somewhere else looking down at me. I'm sitting in the cop car and I suddenly can see myself in the cop car with the cops. As soon as I get into my place, sent the sitter home, checked in on my sleeping child, and stumbled into my bedroom, I collapsed and went to sleep. Thank God I woke up. And I realized I wasn't fine at all. I was in bad shape. Holy shit. Right after the accident, I hadn't been able to process what happened. I thought I had just crashed and that was it. I didn't realize until the next day, wait a minute. I crashed and then the cops were there already. How could that have happened? I had passed out, totally unconscious and didn't even know it. Wait. That doesn't make any sense. For the cops to fucking let me go home? My mind was all scrambled and my leg was fucked up. I went to the hospital and got cleared, thank God, again. But then I had to hobble to the hair and beauty expo later that day. Still not totally sure what all had happened. I sent Fab a picture of the crashed car with a text. "Yo, this happened on the way home. Are you okay?" "Yeah." "Well, that's how you know it was a hell of a party." "Really, Fab?" "Yeah, a hell of a party. He almost killed me." Not exactly, but over the next few days, as all the pieces came together, I had that full-on feeling of, wow, that was almost it. That was the closest I ever felt to death. It wasn't like the fire, when I could have died, or other close calls when I could have died. I was actually out the door and there. But somehow I got pulled back. For some reason, I was spared. This was the time when I felt death and valued the warning. Don't forget this moment. The part of almost dying that terrified me most was the thought of not being on this earth for my son. After that night, I resolved never again to drive tired. If it's been a long day, I'll stay at a friend's rather than drive home. And if I hit the road and start to get tired, I'll find somewhere safe and pull over to close my eyes. Just being more careful may have also helped me to develop more patience in general. Or maybe not. The last highlights of 2007 that I can't forget to mention was getting to interview Senator Barack Obama. Earlier in the year, in the midst of Wello's funeral, I received the announcement that Obama was going to run for president. I wanted to jump for joy. Literally, I was so overwhelmed with excitement and I screamed out for my mom from across the funeral parlor, "He's running!" She was thrilled and whispered back, "That's great, honey." Then came his call to the station as the primary season took off. And I was out of my mind with excitement. This is crazy. Is this happening? Am I for real chopping it up with Barack Obama? He was so gracious, so generous, telling me how cool it was to be on the air with The Voice in New York. And he was just himself and down to earth, admitting to me, I'm old school and generally I'm more of a jazz guy. But having said that, I'm current enough that on my iPod, I got a little bit of Jay-Z, a little bit of Beyonce. In the months that followed, slowly but surely, there was a change of heart for a lot of friends and family who said that Americans would never elect a black president. People got past their fears and even the most skeptical became supporters. The hip hop community soon came out strong to support him. A turning point was will.i.am's Yes We Can video. Again, it was music connecting to the moment, bringing in so many voices we hadn't heard together before. There were so many exciting moments that led up to the day of the election in 2008. The momentum was real and powerful. I'll never forget the morning of election day when I was driving into work and I turned on the radio to Power 105.1, where Ed Lover was now on the air in the afternoons, starting an hour before my show. People had been pitting us against each other, although, as I like to remind Ed, I was killing him in the ratings. Still, I would routinely listen to his show as I drove into work, just to check out the competition. That day, I tuned in to hear him say, "Oh my gosh, you're never going to believe who I've got in the building." There was a beat before he said who it was. And then, to my complete and utter horror, he says, "Oprah Winfrey." Holy shit. Fuck. My life is ruined. I no longer want to live. My ultimate dream interview of life, and she was on Ed's show in the same time slot, talking about this historic election and how much she cared about it. She was so good and so gracious and funny, but of course she was. It's her, the almighty mother Oprah. I could barely breathe. How did this happen? How had Ed gotten this interview? Everybody who knew me understood that this was not an easy loss for me. During my breaks, all I could do was tune into Ed's show and listen. Even though I had my own show to do, I couldn't focus. Besides, the whole city was listening to Ed that day. Oprah had recently received a lot of criticism from the hip-hop community after being super critical about it and distancing herself from the culture, something I had been dying to interview her about. I'd had the conversation so many times already in my head, but there she was, having the conversation with my competition. As much as I wanted to criticize him and hate on him, the truth was he did a great job. I hated the negative feeling I was having. Jealousy, disappointment, embarrassment. And I knew I needed to get them out. So all I could do was release them in the most positive way possible. The second his interview was over, I sent Ed a text. "If somebody had to steal my dream interview, I'm glad it was you. You did an amazing job." Ed sent me back a gracious text telling me that I couldn't know how much that meant to him. And as quick as that, I felt better. The negative feelings were gone. And I learned something that day. To be aware of my own negative energy and the power of finding a way to release it in a positive way. The truth is that I could have held on to that jealousy for a long time. Instead, I felt empowered. Oprah would be proud. It was a big day for me, and it was a big day for our country. Knowing that Nico was old enough to witness history and that he too could be president one day made me so proud. I took him into the voting booth with me and I let him cast my ballot with his little 5-year-old finger. Young Jeezy said it on the trap song, and now we could all say it too. My president is black. Chapter 14. Three Card Monty. The Hot 97 where I grew up was different from the place where I found myself working in the years between 2009 and 2014. Before I even really thought of going anywhere else, there were certain moments of awareness that took place that made me start to think about my life beyond the only radio home I'd ever known. Some of these had nothing to do with Hot and everything to do with me, and my own fears that I couldn't make it anywhere else. It was true that my identity just seemed synonymous with the station, and that my relationships were intertwined. Without Hot 97, who was I? Was it enough to just be me, Angie Martinez? Did I have enough equity in my own personal brand to survive outside of this mega platform that I had helped to build? I knew my relationship with my audience was real, but how would I connect to them if I were to leave? Would it matter to them, or would it be on to the next? I wondered the same thing about people in the industry, even though I knew my relationships were strong. In fact, there were plenty of times over the years that I'd feel humbled when people extended themselves and showed real love outside of my day job. One of the most over-the-top gestures happened one year on my birthday, and I got a call from a label rep saying, "Lil Wayne has something he wants to send you for your birthday, and he wants to know if I can pass along your number to him." It was not strange that an artist would send me flowers or a fruit basket or something for my birthday. I didn't know Wayne. He'd been on my show once, maybe twice, and he'd never really been super talkative. So the fact that he would even call me for my birthday was so weird to me. I gave the rep my number, but was still puzzled. "Okay, Wayne." The phone rang right after that. "Hey, it's Wheezy. I heard on the radio that it was your birthday, and I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday." "Oh, thank you so much," I said. "I have something I want to send you," Wayne said. Can I have my man get your address so I could get it to you? You really didn't have to. Thank you. Sure, have him call me. In 5 minutes, I got a call from some guy that worked for Wayne saying, I need your address. I'm coming for Wayne. I'm going to jump on a flight from Miami now. Wait a minute. You're flying here to bring it to me? Yeah, that's what the man said. This guy is coming from Miami to give me a present. Okay, maybe he's coming here anyway. Who knows? Clearly, this is not a bottle of champagne or edible arrangement. The guy shows up in front of my building at 10 p.m. that night. Out of a taxi comes a Wayne lookalike. I mean, the guy looks just like Lil Wayne, but it's not him. It's clearly somebody from his crew. Hello, Miss Angie, he says. Here you go. He gives me this little box. As I start to open the gift, I ask, did you just get in from the airport? Yeah, I came to bring this to you. You're not staying in town. No, the taxi's going to take me right back to the airport. Are you kidding me? Is Wayne crazy? Kinda, he says. Hold on, I gotta call him. I was supposed to let him know once you have it. As he's calling Wayne, I'm opening the box. And it's a diamond tennis bracelet. An outrageous, brilliant, flawless diamond tennis bracelet. And I'm just staring at it. Why would he do this? What is this? Is this real? Is this like rhinestones? This can't be diamonds. This has to be a $40,000 bracelet. Is he crazy? No fucking way is this for me. I don't even know this man. What is happening? Yeah, I'm here with her right now, Wayne's boy says into the phone. She got it. He then looks at me and asks, do you like it? Yeah. He tells Wayne, yeah, she likes it. And then hands me the phone. Hello? Hey, Miss Angie. In his laid back New Orleans accent. Wayne, why would you do that? Are you crazy? Well, you know, I heard it was your birthday and I started thinking about the time I came to your show and I had a really bad migraine that day. And you told me that you took Imitrex when yours got really bad. And I was just watching you. You was in your bag for 5-10 minutes, like emptying out your whole bag trying to find me one. And you gave it to me and it was the first time I had any relief from my migraine. I've been taking them ever since. And it showed me that you was just a nice person. And I wanted to say thank you and wish you a happy birthday. Wow. Normally I don't accept gifts like this. But it was so kind and so sweet that I just wanted to keep it. I almost felt like he would be offended if I didn't. Thank you so much, man, I said. I don't even know what to say. You don't have to say nothing. Well, you have my number now, so keep in touch. All right, you have mine too, he said. Enjoy. Have a happy birthday. And I haven't heard from him since. Isn't that amazing? He never wanted anything. He never asked me for anything. After we hung up, I debated whether I should keep the bracelet or not because it was so expensive and I felt weird about it. But fate made that decision for me. A short time later, I was on a flight to Miami and noticed the clasp was a little loose. I made a mental note to have it tightened when I got back to New York. Unfortunately, somewhere in transit, it must have fallen off my wrist. The universe took it from me before I could return it. Though I lost the bracelet, I still have the memory of him doing that and the realization of how thoughtful and dope he is. Also, his very generous gesture reminded me that all of the professional relationships I had built would endure no matter what changes were to come. And that was no small thing. I'm always asked what my favorite interview was, and I can never answer that. I've had bad interviews. Maybe the artist wasn't into it. Maybe I didn't ask the right questions. My goals as an interviewer are for me to learn something new about the person and to learn something in general. I want to be entertained. I want to have a good vibe. If I get that, I know my audience will too. The main thing is that I want to feel something. And so I always shoot for that. I love to be surprised. When Dave Chappelle came to my show, we laughed a lot. But more than the laughter, I was enthralled by how interesting and smart he is. It was such a pleasure to talk to him that once the interview was over and we went off the air, we sat in the studio for another hour or two and hung out talking some more. Derek Jeter was another guest who would surprise me. I'm a huge Yankee fan and a huge Derek Jeter fan, and he just represented all that could be good about an athlete. Even now, to this day, for me, with a son who likes sports, there's no role model better than Derek Jeter. and he was just the king of the Yankees and in his heyday when he used to come to the show. As a fan of the station and as a fan of hip hop, he would call in after winning the World Series or come in and do a full interview. He didn't have to do that. He didn't have to do anything. He's Derek Jeter. He really just came because he knew what it would mean to us and to our listeners. And it was surprising and humbling. Sometimes I like surprising my guests. One of my favorite interviews was the second time that I had A$AP Rocky on the show. He's great and he's young and all swaggy. And during our first interview, I found out that his real name is Rakim. Named by his mother after Rakim, the rapper. One of my favorites of all time. That is so dope, I said. Have you ever met him? Your namesake. No, he said, but talked about how much he'd love to one day. So the next time I had A$AP Rocky on the show, I'm in the middle of the interview when I mentioned, oh, remember last time when you said you always wanted to meet Rakim? And as A$AP kind of shrugs, being cool, a typical rapper, all laid back attitude. And at just that moment, as planned, the original Rakim walks into the room. And A$AP Rocky transforms into a little kid seeing the real Santa Claus. What? He came over and gave me a big hug. He couldn't even help himself. The two looked like they were having a long-lost reunion, and A$AP asked Rakim, can you call my mom? It was the cutest. Rocky was giddy. The surprise brought out the authentic, sweet side of him. Rakim was so gracious. It was a great, great moment. For me, it was an emotional high because A$AP Rocky is the epitome of the new generation rapper right now. Rakim is arguably one of the greatest rappers of all time and represents earlier hip-hop, when I was coming of age. So being able to create a moment that was so multi-generational, but so hip-hop, helped me to define my space in the culture. The ability to do that and make it happen was just a perfect moment. I have had other interviews where I felt that I could create a safe space. A little like therapy for artists who needed it right then. Busta Rhymes was someone who was always animated and always happy, who came up to the show when he was physically and emotionally just exhausted. And man, haven't we all been there? He was at the peak of his career, but when he came in that day and was willing to let loose about the challenges, it was brave and moving. Another time I had DMX on, where he was in full tears, exhausted and battling with his demons. And he wanted to talk more, but at that moment I wanted to protect him and had to cut the mic off a couple of times. I think it became known over the years that I tried to do right by people. And with that, I earned their trust. And in those instances, when it became something of a therapy session, as it did sometimes between Mary J. Blige and me, our friendship was there on the air, as much as off of it. One of the times that stands out was when she signed on to do a Burger King commercial about crispy fried chicken. And she got so much flack about it. The reaction really was over the top about her singing about chicken. In her mind, she was just trying to make an iconic commercial like the two all beef patties McDonald's campaign. But the execution of the spot wasn't what she had hoped. As much as that saddened her, nothing disturbed her more than how the public responded. I mean, the internet went bananas. Calling her names for portraying a racist stereotype and for being a sellout. For somebody as beloved as Mary, it's shocking to see how one questionable move could make people flip on you. I hate that about our culture. Mary really didn't react publicly initially. And the first time she talked about it was on my show. How hurtful it had been, not just to see the criticism, but to think that fans wouldn't know her intent, that they wouldn't trust her integrity. Probably the hardest interview I've ever done, and the one I feel proudest of, was the one with Chris Brown in 2009. At that point, I was seasoned and ready. I knew who I was. It was such a sensitive moment and it had not been broached on radio. It was raw. The first lengthy interview he had done after the horrible incident with Rihanna, where the whole world saw what he did to her. Her bruised, bloody face. Yes, he had gone on Larry King and that was awful for him. That was all the public had heard from him. The people were angry. Rightfully so. But my goal was to be fair and hopefully have him confront the truth of it. I had known Chris from the time he was 15 years old. So we had a relationship that made me feel like I could be direct and he could handle it. When he arrived with his whole team trying to be super hands-on, I just wasn't having it. I took Chris out of the room before we started. listen, there are going to be points where I'm going to go hard on you because I have to. I have to be honest in that, I said. But also, I'm going to give you a chance to be heard. And I care about you, so my intention is not to hurt you. But we have to be honest, and I have to tell you how I really feel. No, I totally get it, he said. In wanting to be fair, I thought about how you'd treat a member of your family who'd done something awful. Even in your disappointment, you don't leave them for dead, and you don't disown them. You want to know what happened, and you want to know why. I wanted to talk about it so that Chris could own it, to give him the space to do that. At the same time, I didn't want my audience to think that what had happened was okay. I didn't want any young girl listening to think that this is okay. Not okay. As horrified as I was and as concerned as I was about Rihanna, I also was concerned for Chris. When I asked him if he was okay, he reacted like somebody who had never been asked that question before. For a moment, I thought to myself, if one day my son made a horrible mistake, I would hope that someone would give him the opportunity to make it right. Chris was the young kid who had done a profoundly wrong thing, and he was going to pay, probably for the rest of his life. If I felt like he was getting away scot-free, I may have felt differently. But the repercussions of his actions were inevitable, and I chose to hope that through those consequences, he'd learn something that he could later teach. Angie, I definitely want to talk about how you can redeem yourself. Do you have a plan? Chris Brown, I just feel like whatever God has in store for me, one mistake I could change. I could turn a bad into a positive and take the situation that was in my life and kind of change it and make it into a positive, making people aware of situations. Angie, I want to be careful. Rihanna was clearly the victim in this, but I've got to imagine that this has been awful for you. Chris Brown, yeah. Angie, I see you on Larry King and I'm torn. Like, I don't want to let you off the hook because it's not poor Chris, right? But just as someone who knows you, this has to be one of the most awful experiences of your life. Chris Brown, people don't realize I am human. I hurt, I cry, I feel pain, I feel embarrassment, I feel ashamed. Angie, you were such a role model for the kids. And then everybody was just like in shock. Chris Brown, yeah, I mean, that was one of the most embarrassing things for me too. Because of my image and who I was as a young role model to a lot of kids. And how people look up to me. Even parents and stuff like that. It was hard for me because I let a lot of people down. And I felt that it was like turning my back on a lot of my fans and turning my back on a lot of people. Even the people I love. You know what I'm saying? It was like walking a tightrope. He fucked up and he was going to pay for it. We all knew that. He needed to. But also, he's a human being. And I chose to focus on that while most of the media, even my Oprah, had chosen to ignore the possibility that Chris could be redeemed. That he could learn from this and look at how abuse had played a role in his upbringing and focus his energy on never letting something like this happen again. From my perspective, he deserved a fair hearing, even if he had a lot of work to do as he picked up the pieces of his shattered persona. That was an empowering moment to take a stand that was against the grain and to handle a tough interview and do it well. Owning that also let me appreciate my position within the culture and my unique perspective. I don't know if anyone else could have had that same conversation. I was proud of how far I'd come. At the same time, in this newfound confidence, deep down I was starting to get restless. Things were starting to feel different at Hot 97. There was this new regime and they were making decisions that seemed weird and off-brand. They were adding all these pop records and coming up with all this corny digital content. In the past, when upper management had these bright ideas, they would usually consult with all of us in programming because they valued our knowledge of our station and our listeners. We'd fight to keep the integrity of the brand intact. But more and more, we weren't even being asked by management that had no connection to the culture and our audience whatsoever. It started to feel that we were losing control of the place, like we were losing our voice. I was showing up and I was doing the job, but I began to feel removed. I had never felt this way before. Like the station was losing its heart. Everything was changing. Our morning show with DJ Cypher Sounds and Peter Rosenberg was struggling against Power 105.1's Breakfast Club. Cypher, who was funny and dry, had been at the station for a really long time and was loved by everyone. Rosenberg, newer to the scene, was smart, championed underground hip-hop, and like Cypher, was dry and witty. The two were getting their rhythm, but it was hard to compete with what the Breakfast Club was doing in the market. Angela Yee, formerly of Sirius Radio, DJ Envy, formerly of Hot 97, and Charlamagne Tha God, former sidekick of Wendy Williams, were a force. They were seasoned, they were digitally savvy, and they were provocative. To respond, Ebro, still programming director, would step in occasionally with some edge and help round out Cypher Rosenberg. Ebro was good. So good that corporate eventually asked him to do it on a permanent basis, with the stipulation that he had to give up his job as program director. When Ebro asked my opinion about whether he should make the change, I encouraged him. If being on air is what you want to do and that's what will make you happy, then absolutely. However, I couldn't see the future and how this would affect all of us. The problem was, it was going to take a good amount of time before they found a new program director. And Ebro was still sitting in that chair, but he wasn't protecting us the way our program director had in the past. In this vulnerable position, the fucking TV show thing happened with VH1. For months, there had been rumors of a reality show about the station. But nothing had been said until the day Ebro sat me down in his office. "You know, Mona Scott wants us to do this TV show," he says. "But of course, we would need you to be all in so you could help position how we would be portrayed and all that. I'm on the fence about it. It's risky. Mona was behind Love and Hip Hop, and reality shows that weren't the same type of tone as what I viewed Hot 97 as a brand to be," I said to Ebro. "That's like fast food TV, ratchet TV. Hot 97 was always a little smarter than that. Not to say Mona wasn't capable. She was hugely successful. But I had questions." Ebro assured me that nothing would move forward without my approval, and that he would suggest I be a producer in order to protect the station's integrity. Months passed, and I hadn't heard anything. Then all of a sudden, I get wind that they're negotiating a TV deal with VH1 and Mona Scott. But nobody's talking to me. Nobody's talking to Flex. Nobody's even talking to Ebro at this point. Upper management is negotiating a show on behalf of us without even talking to us. We don't hear about it again until it's already to the point where they're sending us contracts to sign. We get the paperwork. What the fuck is this? These were like the contracts you give to the cast members on Love & Hip Hop, who were virtually unknown and just happy to be on TV. What the fuck? Who negotiated this? The way the deal went down revealed that the people in power now didn't care about protecting the Hot 97 brand anymore. They weren't consulting with us and they weren't paying us shit. We launched a revolt. I marched into our general manager Alex's office. "You cannot do this. This is not okay," I said. "Number one, I'm not signing this. And number two, what you're saying to your staff is that you don't value them. You don't even discuss this with them." In her defense, she was just trying to get it done fast. She didn't want to lose the deal. And I'm guessing that she thought that the big bosses in Indianapolis would be impressed with all the extra free marketing from this TV show. So in Alex's mind, she was doing the right thing, making deals based on numbers. And from what I understood, the numbers were in trouble. Our ratings were fine, but our small company going up against a monster corporation like Clear Channel had other challenges. Like a corner store bodega going up against Walmart. We didn't have anywhere near the same leverage when it came to generating advertising sales, which is the name of the game. And clearly for management, a VH1 reality show could make a difference. A lot of the younger staff wanted to do the show because they were looking to get as much opportunity and promotion as they could. And I couldn't be mad at them. I understood that. But for some of us who were a little more seasoned, me, Flex, Cypher, it was a different story. Our stance was, you have to pay us. and we have to have some creative control, which this contract is not giving us. We fought and fought, and management started pointing fingers at us as if we were holding the station back from this amazing opportunity. Meanwhile, Ebro wasn't doing anything about it. Nobody was protecting us. And now top management was telling us we had to do this stupid show for fucking peanuts. Flex and I go right into Ebro's office and we take turns. I say, yo, this is the stupidest thing ever. These people are talking to everybody crazy. Flex says, what are you doing about it? We know you're leaving to go beyond air, but you're still sitting here. Or words to that effect. And Ebro just kind of puts his hands up as if to say, well, that's what they want to do. I'm staying out of it. Staying out of it? I took that as a statement that he would stand by and watch this bullshit happen. I couldn't believe it. Ebro had always fought for the station and the brand and the staff. And in that moment, I realized how different things had become. His agenda had changed and I no longer felt protected. And the fact that the station had the nerve to slide me this bullshit contract to sign proved it. These contracts, by the way, pretty much want to own you. That's how those television contracts are. You can't do anything. You've got to get approval from VH1 if you want to do any other television show, make any appearances, or a whole bunch of other shit that was just not going to happen. I didn't work all these years on my career to have VH1 and Mona Scott control what I do for the rest of my life. Worse, this is what the people at Hot 97 were trying to do to me. They were going to let that happen to me. In fact, they were setting me up for it. I felt betrayed by that. I also felt extremely protective of the talent that didn't have the tenure that I had and who had less leverage to fight for themselves. Now, not only was I fighting for myself, but I was fighting for the Cyphers and Miss Infos and Laura Styleses of the team. Ultimately, however, everyone wanted to do it, and the majority of the team felt like this was an opportunity they didn't want to miss out on. My solution was to let them do it without me. But I was informed that they would not do the show if I wasn't part of it. Great. If I don't sign on, I ruin the opportunity for the rest of the team. So I fixed a few things in the contract that were really disgusting, and I got my money up a little bit and reluctantly agreed. VH1 announces new reality show. This is Hot 97. BET posted March 6th, 2014. TV station's latest program gives a behind-the-scenes look at New York radio. From their nationally known DJs to their infamous yearly hip-hop festival Summer Jam, Hot 97 has long been known by their catchphrase, where hip-hop lives, and now they're inviting viewers behind the scenes via VH1's newest reality show, This is Hot 97. Then it's time to shoot the TV show. Now we have producers in there who give less fucks about the station than our management did. They're creating a show called This is Hot 97. And now, in addition to putting the station's brand in jeopardy, we all have to put our own personal brands that we have worked so hard to build in the hands of people we didn't know or trust and who didn't know anything about us. It was such a sloppy and desperate move. But you know, the days I had to show up, I showed up. I like to joke and I'm not afraid to try some goofy shit, so I was game for some of it. And once I commit, I'll do it. You want me to act like a fucking idiot? Okay, when do we start? Fuck it. Especially when you're with people that you love. I love Miss Info. She's one of my best friends. So if you put us in a scene together, I'm gonna have fun with her. Right before they called action, I'd turn to her and say, kill me. She'd laugh. No, really, punch me in the face right now. That would be better than this. Then we'd turn to the camera and have our fake water cooler talk. Like on The Office when actors broke the third wall and talked about their meetings. I hated how we got here, but I tried to have as much fun as I could in the moments when I was actually shooting. It got harder and harder as time went by. While I'm going through the motions and laughing at the ridiculousness, I start to realize how Ebro is being positioned on the show. He's the center of every fucking episode. He's doing the voiceovers. He's involved with creating the storylines. Me and Flex are looking at him like, oh shit. He just fucking went and let this show happen because he's about to be the star of this show. And I loved Ebro so much that I said to him multiple times, like, yo, fam, you look crazy. Not just to me, but how do you think that makes it look to these people that you have on the air for 5, 10 years? They're not even on the show. We had a midday guy, Big Dennis, who had been with Hot 97 since I have been. All these years. And they didn't even have him on the show. He'd been there way longer than Ebro. And then there were DJ Camillo, DJ Enough, Mr. C, all these solid personalities. The people that really are in the streets representing Hot 97. And they were not included. And you have Ebro as your fucking star. It was fast becoming a mockery of the station. How sad. For everything we've done, everything we've built, this corny TV show will be our legacy. Ultimately, the problem wasn't the TV show. Had the opportunity come along when we were at our most stable as a station, it might have been different. But we weren't in the same place. For the first time, I felt foreign in this home that I helped to build. Man, we loved that place. We cared about that place. We went to war for that place. And now we're sitting there watching it fall apart. I'll never forget this one day when I walked into work and I realized that the lights were really dim. It felt so dark and gloomy. I'm sure the lights had always been like that. It just had never really bothered me before. Now it started to feel depressing. After all the years and all the loyalty, I started to realize that the thing I was so loyal to no longer existed. Maybe it's time for me to move on. I didn't know what that thought meant. Leave radio in general? Maybe I could move to LA or Miami and open a bar, a restaurant, I don't know. I had no clue what I would do. I just started to sense that I couldn't keep doing this. The first step is realizing there is a problem. And this one was staring me in the face. Chapter 15. It's been a long time. For everything that wasn't going so well at work, my love life was in a new and amazing place. In a roundabout way, the change started back in 2010 or so, when I had a general, "Hi, how are you?" meeting with a lady from Telepictures. She'd had to cut it short because she had another meeting about to start. On second thought, she offered, "My next meeting is here. If you want, though, you can stay and meet him. He's a matchmaker." Single at the time, I was curious. And apparently this guy was good. Like a young hitch, the lady told me. "So do you want to meet him?" "Yes, I do." They wound up letting me stay for their whole meeting because the conversation was so good. The meeting was with Paul Brunson, a good-looking, super smart young man who had married his high school sweetheart. I had one of my "I feel connected to this person" moments. The thought crossed my mind that this was maybe someone I could work with in some capacity one day. Intrigued, I started asking him a zillion questions about what he does, how he does it, and how does he know? Then he turned the conversation to me and asked why I was single. "Because I haven't met anybody." "Well, how much work have you put into it?" When I asked if you shouldn't just let it happen, he said, "No, it's the same way you work on your career. When you want something, you get it done. If you want to be in a relationship, you have to work for it." Work? That was different. And when we got into a whole discussion about who my type was, I had no idea. "Well, let me offer you this. What are your 3 core values?" I had no idea what he meant. He pressed on. "Tell me what your 3 core values are. I want you to think about what your 3 core values are, and then I want you to look for those. Because you can get distracted with somebody who's funny or smart, somebody who entertains you, or somebody's swag. But none of that is real. None of that is the thing that is going to hold you together. So I want you to find out what your 3 core values are, and I want you to start looking for that in somebody else. Because if you don't know what they are, you can miss it. It could show up right in front of you and you could totally miss it." And the 3 things that came to mind right away were family. Family and friendships were so important, and loyalty is right up there. Honesty. It's the core of who I am. And I know everybody says that, but it really is who I am. I like to be honest. even if it's not comfortable. I look for the truth in everything. God. I'm private about my faith, but my spiritual connection to what's good in the world matters a lot. Now what? And why did I have to work at it? Didn't I have enough on my plate as it was? Did I even have time for a relationship? Paul argued that with the right relationship, you can actually accomplish more. In the meantime, Tiffany, one of my girlfriends I've known for years and a much-loved wardrobe stylist, was tired of me not going out on Friday nights and said, look, he's not going to come knocking on your door. Maybe you need to change your circles. Meet some new people. As it happened, she was going to a listening party for Neo at Inc. 48 Hotel, where Idris Elba was going to be DJing. I had been trying to book him for my show, and Tiffany offered to introduce us. I didn't know if I would like him or not, but I knew girls went nuts over him. And I knew that he was a really dope actor and that I'd love to have him on the show. So I went with Tiffany and found myself in the middle of a private party, up on a rooftop of a hotel with music blaring, a swimming pool, and lots of pretty people. When she started to drag me over to meet Idris, I could see that the booth was mobbed. Well, there's his manager, Aronde, Tiffany said. Let's go say hi. Tiff takes me over and introduces me to Aronde Garrett. He says, hey, Tiff, and gives her a big hug. Then turning to me, there's an awkward clash as he goes to give me a hug and I go for the handshake. There was so much noise and distraction, but there was something about Aronde that feels familiar. A tall, dark-skinned guy originally from Brooklyn before going to college in Maryland. Aronde looks at me with a big, genuine smile and asks, do you want to go meet Idris? No, it's too crowded over there, but I'd love to have him on the show. He thought it would be a great idea and then added, but we got to hang out. Not sure what he meant, he gestured to me and Tip and said, what are you guys doing tomorrow night? Oh, I can't do anything. I'm going to a fundraiser for Mary J. Blige's charity. Aronde said, oh, well then, we're going too. Is he trying to be cute? You're not going, I laughed. Why can't I be going to that, he laughed too. The next night, when I arrive at Cipriani's for Mary's Fawn Gala, yep, it turned out that Idris was in fact hosting the event. And Aronde was there. I noticed him sitting a couple of tables away, and just as I spotted him, he waved as if to say, told ya. I laughed and shook my head. After the event, I had plans to head uptown to Harlem for my friend Dawny B's birthday party. Dawn worked for Nike and knew a lot of the same people as I did. As I was leaving, Aronde asked, where are you headed? When I told him, he grinned and said, oh yeah, we're invited to that too. This was fun. A bunch of us headed up to Dawn's party. At one point, I thought my ex might be there, and it tickled me to think he'd see me all decked out, having a great time, and sitting at a table toasting it up with Idris. Then, Aronde leaned over and quietly asked me, in the most direct way possible, are you into my friend? Before I could answer, he explained, because I thought there was a connection with you and me, but now you're over here kikiing with Idris in the corner. It's totally cool if you are, I just don't want to be barking up the wrong tree. Oh my God. Honesty and directness. Thank you, Jesus. I took a deep breath and answered with equal honesty. Well, actually, no, I'm not at all. But honestly, I think one of my exes is here and I was just kind of being a dick. Aronde got it and he got me. Okay, I can deal with that. I'll stop now. Besides, at that point, he had my full attention. We went out to a late dinner that same night and that was it. We've been together ever since. Billboard, February 13th, 2014. Emmis, owner of New York City's Hot 97, buys WBLS, WLIB for $130 million, increases urban market share. Emmis Communications, a radio and publishing company which owns